Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Interpreter Insights Podcast. I'm Terry Hutchinson. My guest tonight is Kevin Christensen, who's been with the Interpreter Foundation and me on Interpreter Podcasts and Interpreter Radio for many years. And our discussion topic for this podcast is going to be Moses. The mission of the Interpreter Foundation is to support the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints through scholarship. We make the latest and best scholarship available to you in podcasts, journal articles, books, seminars, films, and scripture roundtables. We invite you to see what Interpreter has to offer at interpreterfoundation.org. If you like this podcast, please subscribe, tell your friends about it. You can give us a good rating. Because the Interpreter Foundation is not owned or controlled by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the comments we make are solely our responsibility. My guest, Kevin Christensen, and our discussion topic is Moses and the Deuteronomists. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Kevin, you and I go way back, and your writings and I go back even farther. In fact, my introduction to you was in some of the farms material, and I've talked about this on the air many times, but really it was a major factor in changing my life and the way I studied the scriptures. And so when I got to talk to you and got to work with you on podcasts and radio broadcasts, it's been a wonderful experience to me. And so I'm really happy to have you back. But I'd like you to tell us a little bit about how you got involved with Margaret, and especially from the viewpoint of Margaret's take on the Deuteronomists, and maybe you can tell our listeners who the Deuteronomists are, what her position is, and then that will introduce our interpreter subject.
Well, this all has to do with, you know, the transmission of the scriptures, that we don't have the originals. We have copies of copies of copies, and things get passed along and edited and selected, and people decide, so which version we want to tell and what do we have. And I just grew up in the church on the Wasatch Front, and I just went to Sunday school and seminary and institute to a degree. My first introduction, I think, first mention of anything about the Deuteronomists was just like some passing lines in some of Eugene Siech's stuff, but I didn't follow it up immediately. And I had some people mentioning the book by Richard Elliot Friedman called Who Wrote the Bible, which is a popular explanation of the documentary hypothesis, which is the idea that there's different sources that were kind of combined together, different times edited, selected, passed along.
And they have different slants. So you have the Deuteronomists, you have the Yahwists, you have the priestly source.
And every one of them has certain controversies about them. But I did read one thing from Robert Alter, who's talking about it. He says that the one editorial school that everybody agrees on are the Deuteronomists. And this goes back to the account in 2 Kings around 23, when King Ammon is killed and his son Josiah is put on the throne when he's 8 years old by the people of the land. And so he's installed as king. And then when he comes of age, when he's 21, there's slightly different accounts than Kings and Chronicles, but they're doing a refurbishing the temple, and they discover an old document and they call it the Book of the Law. And in the account in Kings, they show this to Josiah and he says, we haven't been keeping the law. And the account gives him launching this reform, where they're just wanting to go back to living the law. And the account in there talks about how Josiah was the most righteous, best, most perfect king since David. So it's a very favorable account. The account in Chronicles has a few differences. The Book of the Law is discovered after the reform begins. The most important difference, I think, is in the Chronicles account is that there's a type scene where there's a disguise narrative. And in the disguise narratives in the Bible, Ellen Goff wrote a really good essay about this, talking about how there's certain narratives in the Bible where a prophet or somebody wears disguise. And in these narratives, the disguise is always immediately cast off. Like there's the account where King Saul goes to see the witch of Endor, and he goes in disguise so that he can consult her. And she says, Saul, what are you doing here? It's like the disguise doesn't do any good. And this is a characteristic of all of them, including the one with the Benedict.
Where do we find Alan's article?
That's in the Scholar's Archive. I guess in Review of Books on the Book of Mormon, Volume 7, Number 1.
Okay,
the one
so that'll be in Scholar's Archive on the BYU
website. Yeah, that's
website.
In Scholar's Archive.
Okay, thank you.
And so he talks about these type scenes. And the other kings involved in type scenes are Saul, Ahab, Jeroboam, and also in the Book of Mormon, King Noah. Except for Josiah, all of those are considered notably bad kings. And by having that type scene in there, I think it raises questions, because the lessons in all of these accounts is they always mark the end of a dynasty. They always show that you can't hide from God and that the king is accountable. These are themes that the tile of these types seems together. And for some reason, the chronicler put that in about Josiah. And I think it's something that most people don't give a lot of thought to. So I think it's kind of an underground criticism of what's going on. It becomes a very important part of how the Bible itself is transmitted, because one of the things you get, say, from Richard Elliot Friedman's book and other people that go along this way, that this period of King Josiah's ministry was crucial for the formation and transmission of the scriptures as we have them. Friedman's book will show you that an edition of the what they call the Deuteronomist history, that's the books of Deuteronomy, Judges, Joshua, First and Second Samuel, First and Second Kings, that an edition of that was written specifically to honor King Josiah during his lifetime. So he becomes the standard against which everything else is measured, and it all falls short. No one is as good as Josiah. They all fell short according to what they think is the most important things. And as Friedman and others will tell you, that an addition to the scriptures was made during his lifetime. Additions were made to talk about his death, about the destruction of the temple, the destruction of Jerusalem and the exile. Those bits are added on. And in the additions, they're also trying to cast blame to explain what went wrong and whose fault it was. And there's three or four different contrasting explanations that are visible in the editing. So they're trying to account for something. And then there's stories about later how, after the return from exile, then there's stories about Ezra dictating the scriptures, and there's things like this. But the background that I had, basically all I knew about Josiah was what I'd read there, because I don't think we ever had any lessons about Josiah. He just wasn't too interesting, even though Zedekiah is one of the sons of Josiah. So this is all very close to when Lehi's operating in the Book of Mormon. Then in 1999, because I'd read some quotes from one of Margaret Barker's books, I kind of just learned the name, and I was walking through a Dallas Half Price Books, and I saw one of her books, The Great Angel, and A Study of Israel's Second God. And so what she's trying to do is to account for the worship of Jesus. How do you go from the sacrifice of animals to the sacrifice of one said to be the Son of God? How do you get from the Old Testament to the New, basically? And The Great Angel was her fourth book. She studied at Cambridge and got interested in this question, and she started working on it independently. She, she realized that in school they really weren't answering her question. They were just treating the Old Testament, the New Testament, and early Christianity as separate compartments. She wanted to figure out how do you connect them, and she decided that the way to figure this all out is go back and reconstruct what was going on in the first temple. That is, go back to Lehi's Jerusalem and reconstruct what first temple worship was. And that took her to taking a closer look at what Josiah was doing. And she can kind of read between the lines, and she sees Josiah's reform as a violent overthrow of the temple priesthood. What was going on before, there was an abrupt and violent transition. And it wasn't just finding a book, but if you read even in Second Kings, you read the accounts that they kill a whole bunch of the priests. And it just says they killed them by the sword. And because the account is from the perspective of the people doing the killing, they all think it's a great idea. But it was in reading The Great Angel, it was the first time I was exposed to the idea that maybe something else was going on.
I love the story of how you came across that volume.
Yeah, I'd seen some quotes in the Farms Review. Two different guys had quoted, Martin Tanner was one of them, and Ross Barron had both quoted the same passage from The Great Angel. And I liked the quote, so it stuck in my head. And I think Barry Bickmore and Daniel Peterson and a few others had been quoting her. So I just saw the name floating around. And then when I saw the book just on the shelf, The Great Angel, I pulled it down, thought that looks interesting, took it home, and I started to read it. And by the time I was halfway through the book, I called up my brother back in, he lived near Dallas in Plano, Texas. And I said, go back to that bookstore and find every other copy of that book and buy them and send them to me, because I just felt like this is important. I wanted to share it. It needed urgently to be shared. So I tracked down all of her other books, got her address, and got in touch with her. And I wrote a book called Paradigms Regained, A Survey of Margaret Barker's Scholarship and Its Significance for Mormon Studies, because I wanted to show that she's going back to 600 BC and is trying to reconstruct First Temple Judaism. The Book of Mormon starts in 600 BC and in that same Jerusalem. And it's been a longstanding criticism of the Book of Mormon that it's too Christian before Christ. And what her work does, and what she inadvertently did, is explained the differences between what we have in the Bible and the Book of Mormon, because according to her work, what we've got in the Book of Mormon takes us back to the original First Temple Judaism. And what Lehi is preaching in the first chapter is exactly the things that the Deuteronomists objected to.
And also, her books posit the theory that those traditions from the First Temple carried down to the time of Jesus.
Yes.
And while the priests and the scribes and those in power did not recognize that, they had adapted it after the Second Temple. But the people who had those first traditions, that's why they recognized Jesus. In fact, that was what got me so interested in your paper and all of the others, was that it was those elements that answered the question for me, why did so many of the common people in particular recognize Jesus as the Messiah? It was not just the miracles. There was something else to it.
There was an expectation, and who expected what is important, because there are different lines of thought, different traditions, and their intention and conflict through the years. And Margaret will show you the tensions in the scriptures, but she also goes outside and looks beneath it, and she looks at the differences between the Greek Septuagint and the Masoretic Hebrew. One thing that I learned from her that I'm still astonished by, that no one else told us this, the Masoretic Hebrew text that underlies, you know, the translations that we use, the King James translation at least, the oldest copies of that dated to around 900 in the Common Era, whereas the Dead Sea Scroll versions of the Hebrew are 1,000 years older than that. Some of them are 100 years before or contemporary with early Christianity. So you're getting different versions. And of course, the Old Testament, as represented in the Dead Sea Scrolls, is very, very close to the Masoretic Hebrew. But Margaret points out that the differences are in the passages that were important to the Christians. There is a deliberate attempt to edit the scriptures in response to the rise of Christianity and the claims Christians were making.
About Old Testament scriptures that supported Christian doctrine.
Yeah. And so like there had been passages like in the Septuagint, and the argument always was, well, the Christians edited the Greek, so you can't trust the Greek, because the Christians had an agenda. They didn't just pass along the scriptures referencing what was written. They changed it to make their case. But what the Dead Sea Scrolls showed was that there was a version of the Old Testament that was quite different than what was passed down in certain key respects, certain key verses, certain key passages. There would be verses that are changed, or a passage where it's been changed by the people transmitting it so that the Hebrew cannot be read. They call these opaque texts, where they can't tell what the words are supposed to be. So she goes into that in an essay called Text and Context in the Great High Priest, and also on her website. So with all of this, then it's become this big thing where my book came out, then several other people have gotten involved in this and written things and articles. And so in LDS letters to this day, there are still different streams of thought on this. And there are those that will say that Josiah, it says he was the greatest king ever, and he launched this reform, so it must have been a good thing. And I started from that position, and then I kind of moved to where I think more along Margaret's lines. And I've made arguments from Book of Mormon and Jeremiah and Ezekiel and things that I've looked at. And we'll be talking about some people at different ways of reading it. We all get to decide which reading we like.
One of the first conferences I was able to attend was 2014. I don't think you were able to be there, but David Seeley gave a presentation there. And I went up to him and asked him afterwards about specifically the Deuteronomists and their approach to the scriptures, because he's working on the Anchor Bible Deuteronomy commentary. He's the successor to Moshe Weinfeld, who wrote the 1 through 11, and then he died. But he said, yeah, I'm really familiar with Margaret's work. I think she has some good things in it. But he said he doesn't take it quite that far. And I believe that Taylor Halverson, whose work we're going to talk about today, and maybe some others, don't quite go that far either. Just as you described, there are these different streams of thought. And I love the fact that Interpreter publishes them all.
Margaret, What King Josiah Reformed, which is the talk she gave at BYU in 2003, changed my view on it. He was the editor for that volume. I also wrote an essay in that volume. And there was essays by people giving the standard reading of Josiah, that this was a great thing that Josiah did. And Margaret's there. They talk about in the introduction that they didn't resolve the tension. Yeah, and I think someone's going to be talking at FAIR this year doing a talk called Vindicating Josiah. My editor for Paradigms Regained was Bill Hamlin, and Hamlin wrote an essay for the Interpreter called Vindicating Josiah.
So people can go back on the website and find those, and I recommend they do so. These are the kinds of things that make the Old Testament and its study so fascinating, is because there are these different streams of thought. While we may not be familiar enough to take them in, if you will, and harden them in concrete, it's a good idea to be aware of them so you understand what the dynamics are. C.T.R. Hayward, who unfortunately, after his academic career ended, became disgraced for some things. But the work that he did academically still stands out. And in particular, he wrote a volume about the different interpretations of the name of Israel. And the chapters specifically involve the different translations and the differences in the Jacob story and how he became Israel through the Masoretic text, the Septuagint, the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Book of Jubilees. And every one of these authors or editors had a story that they wanted to tell. And they made key changes to the language and key changes to the events, or even the order of the events, in order to make their point. And it's a fascinating book. It's unfortunate that it's not easy to get, and it's pretty expensive, because it's a classic example, Kevin, of the type of thing you were just talking about, how each of these people has an agenda. And that's another thing. When it comes to reading the Old Testament, we have to sort out the agenda. But it's helpful because the Book of Mormon admittedly has an agenda, and its agenda is to promote Jesus Christ and to promote the remembrance of the covenants the Lord has made with the house of Israel. So those are the kinds of things that I think we can take with us as tools that make the study of the scriptures so rich and deep, at least for me. Kevin, tell us a little bit about the talk you're working on right now for the interpreter, for the next interpreter conference, and when that is.
Yeah, there'll be the Small Plates Conference at the end of May. I think it's the, and I've got a paper called Plain Precious Lost Restored that is currently, it's almost 70 pages. It just occurred to me that no one has actually gone through the whole Book of Mormon and gathered all of the references where specific things are described as plain and precious. I mean, I've been, First Nephi 13:40 for years, saying Margaret's work is the fulfillment of this passage. But it's like I get so fixated on that one that then I started realizing, well, there's all these other places where it says something is plain or precious, and that there's consequences to losing it that are, when they've lost it, you can tell something.
You can tell. Exactly. Yeah. Volume 59 from 2023, Taylor Halverson, who's with Scripture Central, wrote an article from pages 281 to 292. So, Kevin, it's relatively short compared to most of the things that you've written.
Yeah.
But Nephi wanted to be a prophet like Moses, not a king like David. Tell us a little bit about this. Essentially, there are two major theological movements in Jerusalem at the time of Nephi. One was called what we call Zion theology, where David was the great hero, and the Deuteronomistic theology, in which Moses was the hero. Yeah. And we see that Nephi was more aligned with Deuteronomistic theology rather than the Zion theology. So tell us a little bit about that. And admittedly, Taylor's not here. We're not attacking him. There's a lot of good things in this article. But one of the comments that he made was that the contrast between Zion theology and the Deuteronomistic theology that he discusses may clash with proposals of several Latter-day Saint scholars, such as Neil Rapley or Kevin Christensen. In other words, that Lehi's enemies in Jerusalem were Deuteronomists who perverted original Judaism. And then he talks about Margaret as well. So he acknowledges, I have a different stream of thought than what Kevin says, what Neil Rapley says. We're going to have Neil on this program in the future. Kevin, of course, will be on again. And it's just a real interesting and dynamic discussion. So tell us a little bit about Taylor's argument and where you come from on it.
Okay. Well, he's got this table where he kind of sums it up. He says the Zion theology, based on a land grant treaty, it's unbreakable. It's eternal. Primary requirement is trust. You should have a disciplined response to sin. Jerusalem is the spiritual center. The leadership is in the Davidic king. And the theological center of orientation is the southern kingdom of Judah. In contrast, the Deuteronomistic theology has a vassal treaty. It is breakable. It's not eternal, but is renewable. It requires obedience. The response to sin is punishment, for example, exile, he says. The spatial center is the land. It's more generic. The leadership is a prophet like Moses, and the center is the northern kingdom of Israel. And he's able to show on these points that Nephi is more aligned with the Deuteronomist thing, that there are several places where Nephi tells stories that kind of liken himself to David, but he never mentions David, like the story of killing Laban, where Laban then becomes kind of the equivalent to Goliath. that he's this opposition that he has to overcome and ends up taking his head with the sword. And Nephi does a lot to become a king, or at least functioning like a king. And he says that I'm going to do for my people what I can. And then his successor, you know, is officially a king. But there's the sense of discomfort with the idea of these, the kind of things that undergo that, that underlie that. And then, but he does like to compare himself to Moses as well. Like when he goes up onto the, you know, onto the high mountain and he comes back shining and he shocks his brothers. There's stories like this where it's deliberately likening himself or emphasizing that things that he has done that repeat a pattern, so that he can identify with Moses as someone who's had visions, who's been up on the mount, who's taken him on this across the desert, those kind of things. Robert Alter has been the one that really emphasized, you know, for modern readers to be able to see these patterns and allusions. And that's, his book is called The Art of Biblical Narrative. And when you read that and you kind of see these kind of details in the stories, you realize that this is very deliberate, very artful. It's not plagiarism. Because the idea is if you repeat the actions of a hero, then you're taking on the identity and you take on the roles. Someone acts like a, like Joseph Smith acting like a prophet and doing these things. We see him as a prophet. If Brigham Young leads an exodus out west, we think of Brigham as the American Moses. And so this kind of thing, it's very powerful. And it's the way these things are taught. So I really didn't have anything in here that I object to in what he's pointing out. Just some of the things that I think about, like the idea that the Deuteronomists were kind of associated with the Northern Kingdom. Well, the Northern Kingdom actually took a dim view of David. Somewhere I have an article by Stephen St. Clair, and also John Sorensen wrote a similar article looking at the Book of Mormon in line with the Northern traditions of Israel. And there's some differences, and those differences line up in the way that they identify different threads of authorship or different traditions that make up the Bible, which is a collection of books. It's a collection of these traditions, some of which clash in some ways. But this idea that David wasn't the person that certain groups wouldn't think of as the ideal king. They would look at things about his reign that they didn't like or didn't appreciate. And that shows up in these different traditions. And there's also something else that goes beyond this. There's a place where Nephi is talking about how he's trying to persuade his brothers. He talks about that he's talking about the books of Moses and using that to teach his brothers. Says, but if I really want to teach them about the Messiah, about Christ, I use Isaiah. So Nephi himself has different traditions that he's bringing up that he knows about and that he values for different reasons. And you know, each one might have something that it does better than the other, so you don't throw it away. Isaiah was one that Nephi admired the most, even though he's telling stories where he's likening Lehi and himself to Noah for the ocean crossing. You know, they built a ship, they crossed the waters. Several stories that I think Halverson mentions and some of his sources that he uses refer to all of these. The Noel Reynolds article that's footnoted in here. You know, there's all sorts of wonderfully telling and beautiful allusions back to the stories of Joseph and his brothers.
Yeah, that article, by the way, is called The Israelite Background of Moses Topology in the Book of Mormon. It's from BYU Studies 2005, and you can find it at the Scholars Archive.
Yeah, and this kind of thing really will enrich in our appreciation of the scriptures in ways that just talking about it like in a Sunday school class, you're not going to get as much of it as if you read the articles. So it's great to share. But one of the things I like to do when we share is to point to the great articles where you can get a real great dose of insight. But this is a valuable way of looking at things. And as he says here, that Nephi aspired to emulate the prophet Moses, and he downplays the kingly aspects of his actions. I think that's some very good insights here that help us understand the story.
Well, Nephi admits that. He did not want to be a king. But he, according to Halverson's list, Halverson quotes the Deuteronomistic list. But the Deuteronomists also had these things where they remove certain elements of the scriptures, the personal appearance of God, the Lord of hosts, a lot of the things that Margaret put out. So there's clearly elements here where when I read the Book of Mormon, and maybe you do the same, I know Neil Rapley does, the family dynamic between Laman and Lemuel and Lehi. What is Laman and Lemuel's greatest complaint against Lehi? He's a visionary man. And the Deuteronomists are like, no, there's no such thing as these visions. At least the serious Deuteronomists that Margaret is talking about. Yeah. So somewhere there are some correct aspects of the Deuteronomists, just like you would assume, but it's hard to find if you get them in the total Deuteronomist history. And for me, the story of the kings in Israel, I always have to read it with a grain of salt. We'll have you on the program when we get farther along our Come Follow Me this year to talk about that. But literally, the example I always give is, what if Laman and Lemuel had written, or their descendants, had written the story of Mosiah, Benjamin, and Mosiah? Those three kings in the Book of Mormon, what if they'd written the story from their point of view? How would Benjamin and the two Mosiahs have come off if it had been written by the Deuteronomists? Kind of like every single king, with the exception of Josiah and Hezekiah, come off bad.
Well, and then you think there's this whole line of the kingmen, the tension between the kingmen,
yeah,
mm-hmm, Book of Mormon, and the freemen, and there are ties to that. You know, the MLK root means king, you know, so the Amalekiah has that Malak in there, and Mulek was supposedly a descendant of David. And so there's these people that are wanting to say, we're entitled to these privileges because we come from this line.
Yeah.
And so we're the victims here. And so that's this whole conflict that runs through. You have Sherem showing up.
He's the Deuteronomist for sure.
Yeah, he's clearly. There's one Sunday in Lawrence, Kansas, when Allison von Feld and I were in the same building, but in different Sunday school classes, and we were walking past each other one Sunday, and we'd had the lesson on Sherem, and we both said, don't you think Sherem's a Deuteronomist? You know, we both saw it the same day because we had the same lesson. And it's just, once you know what you're seeing, it's easier to see.
I wish we would spend more than 1 year on the Old Testament.
Well, we have a lot of scriptures to read. Mm-hmm. And so over time, our reading is going to add up, and we have to look at it that way, that we can't do everything at once, but we can focus on different things for a while. And then next time around, if you've learned something new, you can take that new thing to your next reading, not just of the Old Testament, but to the New Testament, to the Doctrine and Covenants, to the Pearl of Great Price, to the Book of Mormon. See things in there that we hadn't seen before. And then the books start to get more exciting because we're realizing, how much have I been missing this whole time that I just haven't known how to see? And then that helps our study become, you know, more of a passion instead of a duty. It becomes exciting to see what we can see that we've missed, and to feel our understanding grow, and to feel ourselves changed by the scriptures as we read them and engage them in this richer way.
Thank you, Kevin. I appreciate your friendship, and I appreciate your comments about this. We will have you on again, because this Deuteronomist thread runs throughout the Old Testament. I agree with David Seeley. One of the things David Seeley said to me was, Jesus loved Deuteronomy. He quoted it more than any other book in the New Testament. So there are some elements of it that I don't think we can just discount. So we can't make it overly simplified.
Yeah,
right?
There's a really good essay by Hugh Nibley, one of his essays in What is Zion a Distant View? Or it's How to Get Rich, and it's really a study of Deuteronomy. What mm-hmm. he points out about that there is that it's a here and now book. There's nothing about the afterlife. It's just, you know, about living here and now. And then where it really gets powerful is toward the end of Deuteronomy. They spend all this time giving commandments, and then at the end of it, they says, and if you don't live up to it, this is what can go wrong. And when Nibley walks through the covenant curses, you realize he's describing the modern world, that we're having these bad things happen, not just because God arbitrarily decided that these bad things would happen, but because of his knowledge and understanding and empathy. If we don't live up to this, these are the natural consequences of our actions. The idea behind the commandments in Deuteronomy is to help us to live a good life. But it's not an all or nothing book. I think there was a book of the law that was found and that it was a good idea. But as Neil Rapley talks about it, it's the people that use the book and what's their agenda. It's not just the book itself. It's the people that are using it.
How do you wrest the scriptures to your own destruction? So
and which verses do you change? And what lines do you take out? And how do you point the Hebrew? So how do you read it this way? And do you decide if it has all of these great commandments and these great things in it, but then we have the passage, we're going to get rid of the Heavenly Mother. No one can have visions. You just have you don't need to go or have anyone go up to heaven to learn the mysteries. It's all written down in the book, and all you need to do is listen and obey, not to see and seek.
Well, thank you for being with us, Kevin. We appreciate it. And join us again on Interpreter Insights. This is Terry Hutchinson, along with Kevin Christensen. Thank you for listening.